I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you on board for another episode, edition, and outing of Life 2.0. And if you're a subscriber to the podcast, you know how this works, but I'm just going to run this through for the people that are brand new to the bleacher seats, as it were, for today. So the Life 2.0 podcast is the latest iteration of 21 and a half years of media work for me on radio, starting way back in Michigan in 1997. And I did a bunch of talk radio then and really built my career up, went to a regional, then a national broadcast, and then went from there to Opal Radio in 2006 and did that from 2006 to late 2009. I was a senior producer for the Dr. Oz Show and the Gene Chatsky Show. We won a bunch of awards. I did my own show on the channel. It was a great experience. Had a great time doing that. And then from there, I went to WGN Radio in Chicago for 3 years. And, you know, that to me was just the highlight. A lot of hard work and a lot of lucky breaks. And being a Chicago guy, to be able to sit on Michigan Avenue in the Fishbowl. It doesn't even exist anymore. The whole building's been sold. So the opportunity to be part of really one of the most iconic call signs in radio ever, WGN, and got to say that for 3 years in rotation. So it was a thrilling thing for me. Did that for 3 years, and then I bounced around and did some more things. And when you're in radio, you kind of have to answer the call where it comes. There's a lot of places I would have liked to skip to just stuck with a couple, but it doesn't work that way. So the podcasting thing came about in 2015 when a fellow named Dan Mason, who was the former president of CBS Radio, happened to hear me on a Saturday morning in his wife's car taking it in to get the oil changed. Then he called me, and next thing I know, we're doing CBS Radio. So it's a very long and interesting journey in radio for me. And here I am with this other podcast now called Life 2.0, which was the... Are you following all this? I hope so, because there'll be a test with questions at the end of the show, not multiple choice either. Bottom line is this. People subscribe to the Life 2.0 podcast. They pay $20 a month. They invest that. That's how I look at it. It's an investment, because even though I may go off the rails a little bit, there seems to be value for them in doing so. And I'm thrilled for that. In this day and age, with digital competition and the pool of podcasting is very large. It's more like an ocean than a pool. Let's put it that way. So to get a toehold or a fingernail hold in this digital media these days and have people who are willing to subscribe and invest $20 a month, $5 a week, that's 66 cents a day for you that are counting. That's thrilling to me. It's a great thing. And by the way, because I am in the vaunted Life 2.0 studios, aka my office, you can hear the cicadas in the background because it's hot. They're heating up. They're doing their thing. So I'm not closing the windows in here to get this soundproof professional deal going. I like the sounds of the outside world coming in a little bit. And that ties directly into the show that we're going to do in a few minutes. I met a gentleman named Eric Soderholm earlier this year. I spoke at Sodder World, which is his wellness facility, in Willowbrook, Illinois, which is about 20 miles outside of the city, 15, 20 miles, somewhere there, right off of Route 83. And I'll let you know how you can find it when the show's over. It was fascinating to me. And my gal pal, Jennifer Weigel, knew him. He's a former Major League Baseball player. He's got quite a story to tell, on and off the field, as we would say. And she said, you really ought to speak there. So I submitted my stuff and jumped through a couple of hoops. And, you know, they checked me out, and it wasn't anything weird going on. And I spoke there. I had an experience that was, it was in the reverse. You're going to have to wait. Let me put it this way. I've spoken from Atlanta to Aspen, from Toronto to Trinidad, from Minneapolis to Montana. I mean, from Chicago to Charleston, all points in between. I've been doing this a very long time. And when I'm brought in to speak somewhere, I'm there to deliver the mail. That's how I look at it. I'm here to deliver the mail that I have. This is what I've been given to do, and I'm going to deliver the mail. Whether you read it or not, I can't control that. When I got there, I wasn't into the talk more than 10 minutes when the mail got delivered to me. But you're going to have to wait to hear what happened on the other side of this interview with Eric Soderholm. For those of you who do not know, he's a former Major League Baseball third baseman. He played for the Twins, the Chicago White Sox, the Texas Rangers, the New York Yankees, from 1971 to 1980. He was selected with the first overall selection in the secondary phase of the 1968 free agent draft by the Minnesota Twins. He won the Twins' job at third base in 1974, had two solid seasons as their starter. He'll talk about that a little bit in the interview before free agency. It's pretty interesting stuff. And then, like a lot of these guys back then and now, he injured his knee, missed the entire 1976 campaign. The White Sox, however, here in Chicago, took a chance on him, and they signed him as a free agent in November of 1976. And the story that he tells about how that all came about, wait till you hear this. It's fantastic. The move paid off as he responded with a career year in 1977. He was part of that Southside Hitmen team that almost made their way into the playoffs. He hit .280, slugged 25 home runs, and he hit his 16 of his 25 home runs after the All-Star break. So you're hearing this on Five Buck Friday. We're just in front of the All-Star break. A lot of teams start to heat up. Something happens. They take that little mid-season break, and, you know, it's like out of the chute we go again. But anyway, he hit 16 of his 25 homers right after the All-Star break, helped keep those Southside Hitmen, as they were called, and I mentioned, in the AL West pennant race deep into September. It was a thrilling time to be in Chicago. It was just an amazing experience to watch these guys. I wasn't real fond of their uniforms at the time, but they were a fan favorite, and they remain so to this day. On top of all that, he was named the AL Comeback Player of the Year by the Sporting News after the 1977 season. He followed up his comeback year by bashing another 20 home runs in 78 for the White Sox. And then during the 1979 season, Eric was dealt to the Texas Rangers in exchange for Ed Farmer, who, for my money, he's calling the White Sox games now with Darren Jackson. For my money, he's one of the best 1-2 combination calling baseball in all of baseball. And there's a reason for that. They're not some guy that was, you know, there's a lot of plug and play going on, because I know a little bit about being behind a microphone. I always have a hard time listening to guys that could plug and play anywhere. They don't seem to lean for one team or the other. It's very milquetoast. It's very middle of the road. They're very articulate and they're very on point. And there's a producer in there giving them a ton of stats and they spit them out with perfection. But I want to hear a guy stumble, in my opinion. I want to hear him to be a homer a little bit for the market they're working in. And Ed Farmer and Darren Jackson are the Heckle and Jekyll of baseball for me. So again, Eric was dealt to the Texas Rangers. Ed Farmer came to the Chicago White Sox, had a pretty good career there. And then he was dealt again after the 79 season to the Yankees, where Eric finished up his career as a part-time DH, a designated hitter. And then he came back, was invited to the Chicago Cubs spring training in 82. But by that time, the knees said, no mas, no mas, and that was the end of that. After retiring from baseball in 82, the iconic Cubs general manager Dallas Green hired Eric to scout the American League teams for the Cubs. At the very same time, he started his own youth baseball camps, which then led him to becoming a private hitting instructor. So, you know, a lot of these guys work the system and move in and out. However, while we do talk about baseball, you're going to hear Eric share some stories on baseball. This was a perfect illustration to me of something that I've heard from other people. I've tried to bring it to the table as much as I can in my own life as well. Eric Soderholm is the perfect living example of who you are is not the same as what you do. That is without question. So after he got out of baseball, he went on to create this healing arts center that I mentioned, the Sodder World. His daughter Misty really had the vision for it, and you'll hear about all that as well in just a few seconds. But sitting down with this guy, who I've known a little bit, I spoke at his place about 6-8 months ago and hope to do it again sometime. But it was apparent to me really quick that rare is it in life that you get an observation up close to watch somebody or have witness with somebody who has made such a serious transformation within their lifetime. We talk about evolution, you know, on a lot of levels. This is an evolutionary change within a lifetime. It is rare to see that. So here's a guy who was, you know, knocked down, drag him out third baseman. It was all about him and how much money he could make. And he admits to all that, so I'm not putting words in his mouth. And then to change into this guy within that space of time of his own lifetime, that's really what the cake is in this podcast. So without further delay, this was a fascinating conversation I had with Eric Soderholm at Sodder World, and take it away, boys. So if you can't tell, I am not physically in a traditional radio studio, because what you hear behind me is a waterfall and the birds are singing and nobody's cutting the grass, so that's good. That'll keep it a little bit easier in my ear. But I am at a place called Solder World, just is about 35 minutes outside of Chicago, which basically is an oasis for the erosion of life. I spoke here in January. It was a really interesting experience. I've spoken all over the world. And when you get to a place where you know you're on sacred ground, that kind of crawls up through my feet and it does not leave me. And the gentleman who is the co-founder of this place, Solder World, Eric Soderholm, is with us today. Thanks so much for opening your office to us.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's open 24/7. And always great to see you, John. And you did a wonderful job speaking here in January, and you saw it in the wintertime.
Yes.
And so now you get to come out here and see the Garden of Eden in full bloom. And it's it's a beautiful place, and it was a dream come true. 20 years ago, my daughter Misty went to San Diego School of the Healing Arts. And while out there studying massage and getting her license and stuff, she went to work for Deepak Chopra. Mm-hmm. And obviously, most of us know Deepak Chopra is.
Pioneer.
Yeah. And she called me one day and said, "Dad, we have got to do what he's doing in San Diego. We've got to create a healing arts center where people can come, have no religious affiliation at all, and just work on themselves and get to the roots of some of their problems and learn how to go within. And we'll teach yoga and meditation and do professional massage and have chiropractors and acupuncture stuff." And I thought,
what?
You know,
I sent you to school
for this?
I'm scalping
tickets for a living, and you want to do what? But a year later, I mean, she kind of got me on the path. You know, I actually said to her, "Who is Deepak Chopra?" Mm-hmm. This was 20 years ago.
Sure.
I had no idea.
Sure.
Ironically, on Channel 11, the very next day, talk about divine synchronicity, he's doing a Channel 11 PBS special all day, selling his tapes and his books mm-hmm. and stuff, and talking about very powerful spiritual stuff. And I couldn't understand him real well because he had that deep Indian accent.
Yeah.
But there was something about what he was saying that was resonating with me. And so I just said, "All right, this must be a sign or something." So I went out and got his book, Perfect Health, and then started reading, and I became an insatiable reader.
Mm-hmm.
At 3 o'clock in the morning, John, I wouldn't have to set an alarm. I mean, I would wake up, and I'd have either a Deepak book or a Wayne Dyer book mm-hmm. or Carolyn Mace or mm-hmm. Marianne Williams, mm-hmm. some kind of book. And for 3 or 4 years straight, from 3 in the morning to 5 in the morning, I read books until I fell back to sleep and stuff. And it just kind of got me on that spiritual path. And mm-hmm. then a year later, she calls me and says, "Are you ready, Dad? Let's do this. I'm ready to leave San Diego now, and then let's do this." So we started with 1,000 square feet in a shopping center. I said, "I want to start small because I don't know. This is a build it and they will come kind of thing. There's no business plan, no nothing, right?" So we'll start small.
Well, there is, but you just don't know what it is.
Yeah, right. There was, at a higher level.
Yeah.
So 1,000 square feet in the shopping center up there on 91st Street. This is a wonderful story. You're going to love this. So we're there, and we're doing okay, paying the bills. All word of mouth, not spending any money. Maybe a little bit of advertising back then, but not much. And so then the people next to us went out of business. And so Misty said, "Well, why don't we take that spot, and let's open up the walls, and let's create a yoga studio also."
It sounds like Misty knows the program.
Yeah, she does. Yeah, been working for Deepak for 2 or 3 years. She knew the program.
Yeah.
So we did that. And then a year later, then the next to them went out of business, next to the yoga studio. And I went out. So we grabbed that space, and she said, "Let's create like a spiritual classroom where we hold spiritual classes and stuff." And I'm going, okay, so I'm going along with this now because I'm on the path now.
Sure.
I'm reading, and I'm all in now, right? So after, we have a 5-year lease, and the landlord comes in 4 years and 2 months, and he says, "Look, you guys are doing okay. Obviously, you've taken 3 spots. Do you want another 5-year lease?" And I go, yeah, we'll probably stay. This looks like this is growing." And so he says, "That's the good news. I'll give you a 5-year lease. But the bad news is that you own 3 spaces now of the 5 that are here. So you're responsible for any maintenance and stuff that breaks mm-hmm. down. And I've got to put a new heating and air conditioning thing on the roof. It's old. So you're going to be responsible. I'm going to have to raise your rent about $600 to $700 a month." And I said, "Wow, I mean, I don't know if we can afford that, right?
Right.
And I teasingly said to him as a bluff, you know, I could probably build a place and have less of a mortgage to the bank than I'm paying you, which was $4,800 a month for the three spaces. And he didn't buy it. He didn't take the bluff. He just said, well, go ahead, see if you can do it, smartass. You know,
and
I go, oh, God, what am I going to do with Solder World now if the end of this lease is up, you know? So, honest to God, John, 3 days later, a lady walks in for her massage. And she says, I know I'm 20 minutes late, but I want my whole hour massage. And I said, ma'am, we're pretty busy today. I don't know if we can do that for you. And she slaps down this piece of paper in front of me on the desk and said, this is why I'm late. It was directions to Solder World that were downloaded off the computer MapQuest. And with a big circle, I mean a big circle and an X, it said on MapQuest, Solder World was located on Route 83 and Nielsen Lane. And I said, wow, this is on Nielsen Lane. We're not on Nielsen Lane. We're on 91st Street. She says, exactly. I've been driving down on this Nielsen Lane, and all there is there is this wooded piece of property. And I've been, and there's some houses on a cul-de-sac in the back. And so I went back there knocking on people's houses. and one of the ladies came and said, I believe it's in the shopping center up there on 91st Street. Yeah. That's why I'm late. I want my whole hour massage. I said, all right, we'll contact MapQuest. You can have your whole hour massage.
Sure.
She walks off to get her massage. Honest to God, John, there's a guy sitting in the lobby. He's waiting to pick up his wife from a massage. He comes up from his chair and he says, Eric, I know you. I was a Sox fan.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, I overheard that conversation that Solder World was located on Route 83 in Nielsen Lane. I got something to tell you. I work for REMAX, and we're the listing agent for that piece of property. And I personally have sold that property twice, and both deals fell through because it's a wetland piece of property.
Come on.
And
he's
sitting in the lobby, overhears the conversation. And so he said, but that'd be okay for you. All you need is about an acre out front, which is buildable. You can build a building, and maybe someday they'll let you create some kind of like Garden of Eden or something in the back. And I go, you know, Joe, that sounds like a great idea. I think we ought to look into that. So he hooked me up with the bank, and we came in and we made an offer to the guy that was way lobo what he was asking, but he had, the deals had fallen through twice.
Right. So any money's good money.
He was anxious to sell it, so we got it at about half price. I bought it. It took about, a year and 2 months or so to get the place done. So the guy in the shopping center ended up giving me a month-to-month lease while this place was being built. My mortgage to the bank here, it was, at the time, it's gone up a little bit now, but it was $5,200 a month, and the shopping center was $48. So for $400 a month more, now instead of being in a cold shopping center, I got this beautiful log cabin A-frame oasis out in the suburbs. And DuPage County, finally, after years and years of arguing with them, let me build this Garden of Eden out back that you just walked.
I don't think you took a breath for 7.5 minutes, and I was holding.
Did I use up all my time on the podcast?
Yeah. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it. Get the hell out.
Thank you. Good night.
You know, and I'm watching you rise up out of the chair, and people could hear your voice going up higher and higher and the energy coming out. And this is the perfect segue to give the first part of the story, because you mentioned that the guy sitting there with the REMAX guy was a Sox fan. So if people listening to this around the country and around the world, they're not familiar, as we are in the Midwest, with Eric Soderholm playing third base and being with the Twins and the White Sox and the Yankees and the Rangers. So we need to rewind a little bit, but that was the perfect open, because I think it makes your journey even more improbable to be doing what you're doing. So you were drafted to play Major League Baseball, which in itself is no guarantee success.
Yes, and I feel very blessed in my life. I mean, how many people can actually say that they were able to experience life and do something that they love doing and get paid for it? It's pretty rare.
Rare.
Right?
Yep.
And so after my baseball career, I got in. I didn't know what to do with my life because baseball was the only thing I knew. So I opened up some hitting school.
Hold on. We're not going to skip over some of this stuff, because the baseball fans will send me nasty notes if I don't dig a little bit.
Okay.
Two of my favorite things. The first one was when you were picked up as a free agent by the Sox. And is it true that you, like, went to Comiskey Park and stood at third base in the middle of winter to feel what it was like?
And that was in 2 feet of snow.
In 2 feet of snow at Comiskey.
Yeah, I was in the first free agency draft pool in 1977. I was in there with Reggie Jackson and some of those kind of famous mm-hmm. guys, and Kurt Flood had done all the battling for us. And so now the owners who had total control before back then, and I'll give you an example of that. Mm-hmm. I'm with the Minnesota Twins for 5 years. My peak salary was $25,000. The minimum salary when I came up, I was the Twins' number one draft choice in 1968, and I made it to the big leagues in 71. The minimum salary was $14,000. My second year I played, I hit .276, had a pretty good year for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in minimum, and I took it.
And this is before big agents in the way.
Oh, like, yeah, no agents, no nothing, no free agency, no nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
Third year in the big leagues, I go in, and he says, well, $14,000, you know, after hitting like close to .280 again.
Too. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going, Mr. Griffith, listen, you know, I think I've proven that I can play in the big leagues, and I think at least $10,000, maybe $25,000. John, you'd have thought I shot him. Honest to God, he reaches in the drawer, he pulls out a piece of paper, and on the piece of paper, it's, look here, on April 12th, you popped up with the bases loaded in the ninth inning. On June 2nd, you made an error, cost us the game. He literally went down 12 things of why he felt I should still be.
Those are all the deductions.
Yeah. Why I should still be at the minimum salary.
Yeah. Yeah.
I held out for 2 weeks, and I got a call from his secretary. She said, Mr. Griffith is reconsidered. Come on in. He's going to give you a raise. So I go in. He pushes the contract in front of me. Here's your new contract. $16,000. Gave me a $2,000 raise. And he says, if you don't take it, you can go sell fish in Miami. We don't need you. Now, that's what it was like back then. All right?
Wow.
So now free agency comes along, and Bill Veeck offers me double my salary to $55,000 after coming off a knee surgery, and he wasn't even sure I was going to be able to play anymore, and either was I, but I had worked my ass off trying to make a comeback.
And you had a pretty good year. You had a couple really good. You were like, well, then that 77 year, you actually became comeback player of the year.
You're right. Yeah, and so I go to sign in the winter. It was November, and Roland Heeman was the general manager, and Bill Veeck was in the hospital for emphysema and a bad back.
Yes.
And after I told Roland, I said, I need to do two things. You know, I wanted, one, before I sign this contract, I need to walk out. And I need to just, and I had no spiritual understanding or anything at that point in my life, right? I was driven by my ego and all that. But something kept saying, just stand out there and feel if it feels right. I am standing at third base in a foot and a half, 2 feet of snow, just looking around at the stadium and feeling if it felt right, and it just felt glorious. I went in, I signed the contract. My other request, I said, I'd like to meet Bill Veeck.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, well, he's in the hospital. And he said, well, hold on, let me call him. So Roland Heeman calls Bill Veeck in the hospital. We just signed Eric Soderholm. He'd like to say hi and meet you. He said, send him over. So they run me over to the Illinois Masonic Hospital, and I walk into the hospital, open up the door, and this is the sight I see. Bill Veeck, his shirt wide open, his leg propped up on a pillow, and it's a wooden leg, which I wasn't even aware of at the time.
Yeah.
And the thing that got me the most, I didn't even say hi, was I noticed the ashtray was built into his wooden leg. And the thought came over my mind, I said, no wonder he's in the hospital for emphysema and a bad back. If you got to put an ashtray in your wooden leg, you got a real bad addiction, right?
And you know, here in Chicago, he was a legend.
Oh, he's,
we all knew these.
He was like my second father.
Yeah, really
me.
An amazing human.
So I said to Bill, I'm so pleased to be with the White Sox. He said, man, we need a solid utility player like you. We really appreciate you. And I said, Mr. Veeck, I'm not going to be your utility player. I work very, very hard. I'm in great physical shape. I'm stronger than I ever have been training with Nautilus. I'm going to be your everyday third baseman and have a big year for you. And he said, son, if you do that, you come see me at the end of the year, and I'll take good care of you. Now, he already did at $55,000.
Sure.
Up from 25, right?
That's huge.
So I go out, have a big year, hit .280, hit 25 homers, and we almost win the pennant.
That's right.
I mean, it was a
very
exciting year.
The Southside Hitmen. That's right.
At the end of the season, there's a note in my locker. Come see me, Bill Veeck. I walk up to his office. He's got a 2-year contract for $300,000.
Get out of here.
Honestly, he remembered what he told me in that hospital room.
For $300,000.
He gave me a 2-year contract for $300,000, and I said, wow. And I took it immediately. Unfortunately, Richie Zisk and Oscar Gamble, a couple of the guys took off for greener pastures in the free agency pool.
Yeah.
So I was literally stuck there by myself.
Yeah.
And he brought in Bobby Bonds Sr., you know, he was at the end of his career.
Yeah.
And a guy named Ron Bloomberg that they thought was a prospect who turned out to be kind of a bust.
Mm-hmm.
And nice guy, but he didn't pan out to what they thought he was going to be. So, I mean, we literally went from almost winning the pennant to 20 games under 500 the next year. So it was quite a swoon, you know. But it's all life and those kind of things. You know, life in general is just great lessons and great things that you learn along the way. And all of that has led me to this point right here.
And that's to me is the seesaw, you know, the up and down of things. So your consciousness at that point when you're playing ball, as you said, was all ego-driven, all about me, what can I get? And that's part of the game. I get that.
Yeah.
And yet you still were smart enough to listen to the little nudge to, like, go stand out here and go see this guy. And you can see the difference in the consciousness Bill Veeck had compared to the guy that wanted to pay $16,000.
Uh-huh.
And this was an emphysema, cigarette-smoking, bare-chested out-in-the-outfield guy who understood human behavior probably better than the other guy did.
Well, he was always rooting for the underdog. He loved the underdogs. He loved giving people a second chance.
Mm-hmm.
He loved entertaining people because even if the product on the field wasn't good, I mean, he had trapeze artists,
hit the little belly dancers, the midget guy.
He had all kinds of entertainment going on. So
smart,
you felt like
ahead
he
of his
got
time.
Your money. He really was. He just didn't have any money to speak of. I mean, compared to what a lot of the other owners had, you know. So he eventually sold out to Reinsdorf and those guys. And
No more midgets then.
All that stopped, and now it's big business. And now you go to the ballpark, and it just doesn't seem as, as homey or as
like
it used to be. You know, now it's like big business. You just feel it, all the players now. I mean, if you get called up to the big leagues now just there for one day, you're now prorated at over a million dollars minimum wage now.
Yeah. You know, we have a mutual friend, Randy Hundley. I was golfing with him for a couple of weeks ago, and I was telling him as we were out 100-degree heat golfing, which is really ridiculous, but we were out there for most of the day, and part of the conversation comes back to what you're talking about. When I was a kid growing up in Chicago, when we were waiting on the corner for Santo and Beckert and Banks and Hundley to pull up and all that, they were – closer to our dad as regards to how, I mean, they all had jobs in the offseason. You know, Richie Hebner was a grave digger at one point, you know, so these guys were so much closer to how we saw our father or our parents. But now the gap, not just, I mean, you can go to Wrigley, it's still a great place to go, but the gap between who's in the stands and the guys in the field seems to have gotten so broad that it's really difficult to close that.
I agree with that. It's now big business. You know, the world is just all so high tech now, and I almost feel out of place now. I don't know about you, but being one of the baby boomers now, I'm 70, and it's like I'm sitting there, I'm seeing my son just making the computer dance, and I'm going, oh my God, this is just unbelievable. So I made
we have analog brains in a digital world, my friend. It's a big difference.
Yes, for sure. So. Yeah. So it's just a different world now. You adapt the best way you can. But fortunately, I'm getting near the twilight years of my life now. And so I can go out waking up in the morning now because I draw on baseball pension and Social Security. And so I make enough to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking to get any more stuff. Lord knows I don't need any more stuff. I can't give this stuff away now.
Mm-hmm.
I wish somebody would have taught me earlier on in my life that it's really not about accumulating stuff and comparing yourself to Joe Blow next door who's got a Ferrari and you got to keep up with the Joneses kind of concept. I wish somebody would have taught me back when that it really isn't about stuff. It's about experiences.
Yeah, that's right.
And so if you spend your money on experiences, you're way ahead of the game. Don't accumulate. I got so much stuff now that I'm so anchored. And I like it here in Chicago. I love it here in Chicago. But I got a nice home over here, and it's just you open up a closet door, and shit from 40 years falls out on you, you know? That's been hiding in the closet, you know? But my wife, God love her, I love her. I've been married to her 48 years. She just has such attachments to sentimental value and things of that nature, and it's like, oh, Lord have mercy. Yeah. It's a rough go. But I'm going out in the twilight of my life now, waking up in the morning going, all right, where do I want to play golf today? Okay, if I don't want to play golf, I think I'll go to my spa and get a massage.
Yep.
Okay, and if I don't want to do that, I think I'll just go out by my koi pond in the Garden of Eden and sit with some friends and just have some very deep conversations and watch the koi fish and watch the beautiful swan swim and feel that peace that even Jesus talked about in the Bible, and I'm not a religious guy, but I mean, he talked about this peace that surpasses all human understanding.
Right.
It must be attainable, or he wouldn't have talked about it, even though it said it surpasses all human understanding. I think I found that now. And that was a quest of mine to find that. Is that possible?
Is that so? It's hard to miss when you walk up to this A-frame, this beautiful wood A-frame that you have here, to see the statue out front for your dad. Mm. And to see the influence that he had and continues to have on this place, this rudder that he was in your life and remains, obviously, because this place is in tribute to him. And then there's a place for your mom over here, and I read what she had. So you're in between these two steadfast human beings that really had a big impact, and yet you've been able to kind of go past the traditional upbringing and create this too. So do you see like this arc between the guy you used to be and the guy that you're still becoming? Do you see the connections between the two?
Well, absolutely. Everything that happened to me has led me to this point. And so if your goal is to find that peace, then you have to be committed to working on yourself. I don't believe that, I was raised in a Christian home, okay? Mm-hmm. A very strict Lutheran. We went to church on Wednesdays, catechism on Saturdays, church on Sundays. It got to be so much that they had to bribe me, say, hey, we'll go to Krispy Kreme donut after church today to entice me to keep going. But I was always, even at 9, 10 years old, I was always disturbed by the minister up there going, well, God loves you, and yada, 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 but you're this poor, miserable sinner, and you need Jesus to save you from your sins, and yada, yada, yada. And I'm going, if I don't believe that, quite frankly, I'm going to hell for eternity? You know, but wait, you just said God was love, and if you loved your son, you're not going to send him to hell for eternity, right? So it's like, I never bought, even though I was raised in that very strict home, I think I was there to show me the contrast. All right, so now it made me seek and study some other world religions and to find out at the core of all of them that Jesus wasn't a Christian, Buddha wasn't a Buddhist, and Muhammad wasn't a Muslim. Mm-hmm. But their religion was love.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the theme at Sodder World here. There's no religious affiliation. It's about love and about you finding your way inside. The kingdom of heaven, Jesus said many times, is within you. So you got to go this way. Too many people think it's out here.
And that it costs X amount to get it.
You get it, right. By the way, give me 10% of your income, too.
Right.
You know, and so I just wanted to create a place, and it wasn't done just by me. This was a team effort.
Yes.
To where people could come with an open mind who maybe would even consider the possibility that maybe you're an eternal spiritual being. Maybe you're just experiencing a brief moment of 70, 80 years, if you're lucky, in this moment of time. But you are always you throughout eternity. And if your soul wants to experience another physical form, it so can do. So it's like a blueprint almost before you come here. You kind of go, all right, what are the healing, what are the splintered aspects of my soul?
There
what do
go.
I need to work on? So you kind of create, it's like creating an essay in college. You did the what do they call it, the table of contents first,
mm-hmm,
where you
mm-hmm.
did like Roman numeral 1 is going to be this topic, and then under 1 is going to be A, B, C, and then Roman numeral 2. I think we kind of do that before we even come here. So we put ourselves in situations to help us learn and grow and evolve and get to the point where you need to fix the healing or the splintered aspects of your soul that are out of balance. It's all about balance. It's all about finding unconditional love, not love based on condition. That's in the second chakra. That's all about the sex thing. That's love. I'll love you if, but don't dare look at somebody else or whatever. That's all love based on conditions. Where you eventually evolve to is an understanding of unconditional love, which is allowing others to be who they need to be. It's not your job to fix people.
Right.
You just stand in your light. You fix you. And just by fixing you and that energy that you put out, now will attract new people into your life that you can serve and help to heal also. And so it's just been a wonderful journey, and I just am at such peace, and I just highly recommend it for everybody. You're not going to find
highly
it.
Highly recommend
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I don't know if you're going to find it seeking in churches and mosques and everywhere. You're going to find it when you go into your heart and when you get still and you get quiet and you learn that there's something guiding you in your life that's not your ego. You have a choice. You can steer your true life with the ego like I did earlier, or knowing that there's a higher self, an internal guidance system that you can listen to, and let that steer the ship. That resonates with truth always. That resonates with unconditional love and peace and joy. It's your choice. You're the one that's creating your reality. There's not a God up there, John, and you know this very well, that goes, man, I really like that Eric Soderholm guy. I'm going to make his life fabulous. But I don't like that John St. Augustine.
Right.
But so I'm going to make his life suck.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know that's not the case.
Correct.
So but you have to work on you.
But that's a consciousness shift. And one of the things that we took a little walk around your office here. It was interesting. Well, we could stay inside where I did the talk, which is a beautiful space. And you said, or we go to my office, which is the koi pond outside.
Yeah.
But we took a walk around, and there's this part of the path about fear. And you mentioned about you don't have to go look. It's inside you. But my experience has been, and we had some of the experience when I was here in January. I spent time with a young woman who I do not know. But I've become really adept at asking people questions they just don't ask themselves.
Mm.
And then they have to go look at it. There was nobody, there was nowhere to escape to. There's no television. There was no diversions. We were all together in that. And I think we all did that together with her. But there's this one part on the path about fear. And my experience and observation and opinion has been that to boldly go where no person has gone before is an inside journey, which most people, it scares the shit out of.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you suppose?
Well, because it requires change. I mean, your life has been this way for so long, and that fear path also says our two biggest fears are fear of public speaking and dying. All right, those are what people say are our two mm-hmm. biggest fears as mm-hmm. human beings. When in actuality, our two biggest fears are change.
Mm-hmm.
The transformation of self is our biggest fear. It's like it seems like it's a step over the Grand Canyon, but really it's just 1 foot forward.
Yeah.
1 foot forward, 1 foot forward. And you're seeking. But when the seeking stops, then the being can become.
Like it all catches up to you.
It catches up to you eventually. Yeah. Took me a lot of years, a lot of years of reading books and stuff. And finally, I got it intellectually. And I was speaking in front of crowds and stuff mm-hmm. intellectually. But I remember catching myself saying something to the people and going, oh, man, I need to be doing that myself.
That's right.
And I haven't been doing that. So as you teach, you learn.
That's right.
And then eventually you get to the point where you become it. So my motto in my life now is four things. You know it. Know what it is. Really know it. All right. It's beyond belief. It's a knowing.
Yes.
All right. Be it. Just really be it authentically. Do it effortlessly, because when you're in line with the universe, it goes downstream. It moves downstream. You may have a little bump here and there, but it's nothing that you can't overcome.
Mm-hmm.
So do it effortlessly. And the fourth thing, and the most important thing, is be silent. I don't have to be shouting from the rooftop, hey guys, I get this now. I get this whole life journey now. I'm shouting it from the rooftop. That pedestal's a tough place to be, man. They can't wait to knock you off of that. And I am not on a pedestal. I am not claiming that what I know, what you know may bring you peace.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, God bless you. My sister is very much active still in the Lutheran church that we were raised in. And she's like an associate pastor. And we know that we have different philosophies, all right? But when we get together, we have agreed that, you know what, let's not go to that space.
Right.
Because we don't want to have any resistance or conflict. Let's just love each other unconditionally and honor and let each other be who they need to be. If it brings her peace to be in that state,
right?
God bless you. That's wonderful. It didn't for me, so I had to look elsewhere.
The concept of the ego, and by the way, we're speaking with or talking with. I don't like speaking. We're talking together. Eric Soderholm, we are at Soderworld. And the sound you hear in the back is starting to lull me to sleep a little bit.
Maybe it's my conversation.
Well, no. This waterfall, my shoulders are a little bit more relaxed. I want to take my shoes off and stretch out on the hammock. But these are the kind of conversations that are rare for people. You know this.
Oh, of course.
One of the reasons I even do this podcast, I've turned down literally millions of dollars to not do political radio. I could have made millions. I could have been like a Limbaugh guy, but I wouldn't be able to sleep.
Right.
I'd eat well, but not sleep well.
Right.
I could have done the whole sports thing. I've had four or five agents like, you played ball, you should. But those lessons ended to some degree when I stepped off the football field. I carry some of it, but I don't want to spend. I have a hard time watching sports now. I can't connect to the everything, every minutia piece is dissected. And best thing they could do is have two guys argue over a better athlete when neither one of the guys talking were athletes. You know, I can't do it. So this seems to be, in my own way, how I pay for the space I take up on the planet, that I want to have conversations that inform, entertain, and inspire, that if you get one little nugget out of this, somebody's life goes in another direction. Whether they ever get to Solder World or not, we're bringing it to them to some degree. And so I'm watching you get younger and younger in front of me as you talk about these things, and I'm thinking, so many people don't know how to fill their batteries. We sure know how to drain them. Mm-hmm. We sure know how to go on the Eisenhower at 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. You'll want to turn into some sort of knuckle dragging behemoth. So when we came here, when we were walking around, a gentleman I noticed was sitting in a chair. You mentioned hi to him. We're sitting there talking. I'm like, I get the feeling people just, when they've had enough of the erosion, they've had enough of what's going out there, they just show up here and sit. Is that common?
Oh, it's very common. I let everybody know that my office is open 24/7.
We've even 365.
Yeah, 365. It's open. We've got now these solar lights out back now that shine on the trees, and the lily pads in the koi pond light up, and fires light up, these fake fires light up, and these tikis and stuff. It's beautiful at night as well. And so I just let people know, look, my office is open 24/7. All are welcome.
You're just the caretaker.
Which
literally.
And I may be sitting there with you when you come by.
Yes, literally. I'm waiting.
And then we'll get in a deep conversation.
Like this.
Yes.
Literally, I'm watching Eric pull weeds out front. I'm like, that's full service. He runs the place. He pulls weeds. He does the deep. And that's, I think, what stewardship's all about. Because I don't, as Wayne Dyer used to say, you know, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop
wax
wood,
on,
carry
wax off.
Thing. And something, you mentioned Carolyn Mace earlier, and Jennifer Weigel and I were together not that long ago, and she's mentioned something that has stuck with me, that Carolyn Mace said, that the moment you think you're special is the moment you signed up for suffering.
Oh, God, yes.
And, you know, we watch pro athletes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something people can relate to, and yet we still put them on the pedestal, and then we say next when they fall off.
Oh, listen, I got that experience of a brief moment of fame, you know, for about 10 years in the major leagues, where people were, oh, Eric, can you sign it? Oh, I love you. You know, I mean, just a constant for years and years and years. And it just, I don't know, I'm sure that they were sincere. It just that I felt like that pedestal, you know, like I was higher or better up. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying to people, look, I'm just like you. I'm just a guy that had baseball skills.
Right.
You know, you're probably really good at painting, or you're really good at something. Find out what you're really good at.
Mm-hmm.
And do it. Life is short. Just do something that you enjoy doing and live within your means. That's the key.
Because
too many people go to college, they get in these huge college debt loans, they got to go out and make X amount of dollars, and that stress of having to repay the loans and gets them off to this horrible start.
Yeah.
So my grandkid wanted to go to college, and I said, Mikhail, listen, do me a favor. You're going to go 2 years of college, and it's going to cost your mom $30,000-$40,000 easily, if not more.
Yeah.
And what are you going to learn in 2 years? The same things in history, English. You know, they get 2 years of you before you can even get to your vocation or something that you're interested in, right? So you're going to put your mom in debt, you in debt. I said, I think you're a healer. Why don't you just come, go to massage school. Your mom can teach you. Learn how to be a massage therapist. She started studying astrology. She got into this whole thing. Now she's working for a chiropractor, working here at Solder World Reception. She's getting her license for massage now, so she's going to be making decent money. And she's going to be doing astrology readings here at Solder World. And she's already got $10,000 in the bank.
Yeah.
And she's 19 years old.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And she lives at home for free. And I said, live at home as long as you want.
Yeah.
But when you go out into the world, you got to have some kind of financial base to help you cover emergencies or whatever that may come up. So you don't want to go out in that world all stressed to the max before you even start.
Well, most, and you know, look, and once you've been around long enough, you got 10 years on me. We both have a lot of miles. We both have these experiences.
You're 60?
Yeah.
Man, you look good. I would have guessed 50 or 51 or
45.
Well, not 45.
That's pushing it.
You're certainly young 50s. You look great, John.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, but that's all about the things you talk about. I learned long time ago that it's not what happens to you, it's how you respond. Because if you stay what happens to you, you have no defense. It'll drain you. It'll suck the life out of you. And we all have these experiences that do that. So that, coupled with my insatiable need to be a gym rat, I don't lift the weights like I used to, but I'm convinced that you know, this is a machine I was given, and if I don't take care of it, it'll break down. So why not be proactive and do that? But 55 or 50, I'll take that,
yeah,
brother, no doubt.
Yeah.
But in all of this, you know, the world has us chasing ourselves. I'm convinced of that. I've seen it time and time and time again. I don't think unless you get your defenses up, you talked before about the knowing versus believing. I don't think most people know what their knowings are.
I'm going to tell you a great story about knowing. I got a chance to play with Rod Carew.
Whoa.
And he was a 7-time American League batting champion.
Whoa.
And so one day we're playing the Orioles, and he goes 5 for 5. Now, not that that was a miracle. Because,
I was going to say, because he did that a lot.
He did that a few times, right? But the interesting thing about this particular 5 for 5 was that now one of the balls left the infield.
What?
He drag bunted down the third baseline twice that you couldn't have rolled him down there any better. No way Doug DeSantis could throw him out at first. He hits 2 mediocre ground balls past the pitcher up the middle where Belanger caught him.
Mark Belanger.
Yeah. Spun around and threw, but Rod was very fast, and he beat them both out. The last one, John, hits home plate and goes straight up in the air 20-some feet,
yeah,
and then the pitcher's waiting for it to come down. He catches him, boom, boom. It was a bang-bang play at first base, and the umpire goes, safe. 5 for 5. Now, get this. I'm 0 for 4. I hit 4 rockets. 2 that I thought were home runs that were caught at the warning track, deep in the warning track.
Yeah.
A line drive at DeSantis at third base that he caught and actually took his glove off and shook his hand.
Yeah.
And a line drive up the middle that Belanger dove and caught. I am 0 for 4 with 4 rockets. He's 5 for 5 and not a ball left the infield. I'm sitting in the sauna after the game. He happens to walk in. And I said, Rod, I said, it's amazing. I said, I've never seen anybody get base hits like you. It rains base hits when you're up there. He looks at me very seriously and says, Eric, I don't have a magic wand. You want to know the difference between me and you? I said, I'd love to. He said, can you look me in the eye and tell me that you believe that you're a 300 hitter in the big leagues? I go, well, I'm kind of a rookie still. I mean, I'm in my second year. I'm stuttering.
Yeah.
I don't know how to answer. And I go, no, I honestly don't think that I can. He said, let me tell you something. I don't believe I'm a 300 hitter either. I know I'm a 300 hitter. And that was a valuable lesson that there's something beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
There's a knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that Jesus said about the peace. It's a peace that surpasses understanding. Mm.
And it's
attainable.
And I will tell you that anybody listening to this podcast may not have been in the situation with Rod Carew, but it's a great metaphor. I do know that everybody listening to this has a pivot point in their life when their beliefs were tested and found out to be false. That is an opportunity that looks like a liability. And most people have a belief system handed to them.
Like, oh, yeah.
Growing up in Lutheran church.
Well, you were conditioned on the fear path. You just showed you that.
Without any firewall to hold it back. This is how life is. This is who you are. This is what you'll do. And that's the way it is. This pivot point comes and knocks on the door. And then you have a choice. And my experience, observation, and opinion has been most people, Eric, don't even know they have a choice.
Well, that's the greatest gift that we have given to us is the power of choice. You may think that you don't have a power of choice, and you may think that you're not creating your reality, but you are. Now, you bring with you a lot of stuff that has your Akashic records, your soul has accumulated over your existence, which has been around a long time, and you bring stuff with you. You leave kind of the baggage when you die. You leave it at the door, and you go in, you experience what unconditional love is and stuff on the other side. But when you decide to come back into physical form and stuff, that bag that you left at the door, you're picking up again.
That's right. Yeah.
And you end up, but what I learned was that you were made perfect for what you came here to accomplish.
I did a TED Talk last year in Ontario called Human Math. And my best grades in school were lunch and gym. So math is not on my agenda because it's a language.
Yeah.
I didn't understand the language of math. So thank God for calculators. My dad was a banker. He understood the language of money, but math was always a struggle for me. And so over the years, I started looking at these things and wondering about life expectancy, which was how long you live, not how you live that time. And it started to change for me. And so I started looking at life expectancy as, what do I expect out of life? And then what does life expect out of me? And so I started doing the human math. And in linear math, how we're all taught in school, we all learned by fourth grade our multiplication table. So if I said 12 times 12, everybody knows it's 144. No matter where I go in the world, because it was a baseline educational piece for everybody in the world, 12 times 12 is always 144, from Mexico to Montreal, from Chicago to Chattanooga, from Aspen to Atlanta, across the board. Everybody knows the answer. But that's linear math. It adds up no matter what. Our lives rarely add up no matter what until we started getting a consciousness around them. So I started looking at the average lifespan of humans in the United States, and I actually threw my Canadian friends in as well, because I did the talk in Canada. They live about 3 years longer and sometimes better than we do. But it's a consciousness thing, and I started looking at the, not the years you have, which sound long, 77.5 being the average. Oh, that's, I got 25 more years. But I started looking at the days. And when you take the days down, then it becomes like 28,324 days on the planet. And it's being deducted. So most people go, look, I'm 60 and the average is 77.5. I got 17 and a half years more to go. But human math says you deduct. So you started with 28,324. I've already burned up 15,000. This is your remaining balance every day it goes down. And people go, oh, shit. And that's the kind of consciousness, I think, when you get a pivot point or a perspective change that allows those choices to take place. And I know, you know, I've been thinking about Misty during this whole conversation. You come from a background. Your wife comes from a background. You have all these influences. But here comes your daughter through the middle, apparently, running an end around and goes, Dad, we need to do this. So where does that come from in her at that time in her life that sent her as a seeker? Any thoughts on that? Because she's the main driver, really, why this place exists.
I did Akashic Records reading with a guy named Greg Zira here at Sada World. And in Akashic Records, you can give them permission to open it up, and it gives you your whole, what it's all in your subconscious mind. It's your field, your energetic field. It's all there.
It's the whole blueprint.
The whole blueprint is there. And some people have the talent, whether you believe it or not, to read that for you if you so want it. They can't go in it without your permission, mm-hmm. but they can go into your library. Let's call it a library if you'd like. Well, when I had the Akashic Record reading, I asked about Misty. And Misty and I have been married. We have been brothers and sisters. I mean, we have been together in multiple lifetimes. In Egypt, in the mystery schools and stuff, that's where her background is. Mm. And she understood it way more than I did at the time. And so she's actually been the catalyst in my life to get me to look at things from a different perception. That's the miracle, John.
It's the perception.
It's the perception.
Yes.
You know, you have two ways to look at something. Somebody wrongs you. I can, A, take it personally and get offended and let my ego attack back and then create this tension, energetic tension between us. Or I can say, you know what? That's his problem. I don't believe what he's saying. I'll give you an example. I wrote a book, Conditioning for Baseball, back when I was with the White Sox, with the help of the Nautilus people to help them promote
Arthur
Nautilus.
Jones and
Arthur
the whole
Jones.
Crew. Yeah. What a great concept.
Dr. Ellington Darden.
Yes, it was great.
And I helped them get on the map. And so, damn, I can't believe I completely lost.
Apparently,
that's
that
early dementia.
You're right.
I forgot. Anyway, go on to the next question. Yeah. I'm sorry about that.
So in the last couple things. First, I always like how I look for the threads through all things, the connected dots. My opinion's been, and my observation and my experience, which is a redundant thing. I say those three things all the time to remind myself, this is just my opinion. This is just my experience. And then my observations around give me those two platforms to speak from. So somebody could have a totally different opinion, observation, experience, but there should be some common ground that the people
I think it was about perception. We
That's
were talking about
it
that.
I knew if I talked long enough.
You kept talking, it would come back to me. Yeah,
because you weren't listening to me.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how I was going to answer, and then I got off on a track. But the miracle in our life really comes when you can really are okay with changing your perception and the way you look at things. I can look at it from the ego's perception and take offense. I know the story I was going to tell you. I wrote a book called Conditioning for Baseball. And back then with Nautilus, I had six-pack abs. I was in great shape, right? So now, this is several years back, somebody comes up to me and says, Jesus, I got your book. Can you sign this? And then he looks at me and he says, Jesus, you gained some weight. What what happened? Now, I have two choices.
Yeah, yeah.
I can either get pissed off and respond and attack back, or I can say, you know what? I got to keep my love tank full.
Yeah.
You see, that was the point I was trying to make. It's your perception.
Yes.
If you don't believe what they're saying about you, just laugh about it and turn it around and make something funny about it. But people get so attached and offended by what people are saying to them, they take it personally. And if you've ever read the book by Don Miguel Ruiz, The Four Agreements.
Just talking about it earlier this morning.
Yeah, the first, you know, one of the
number one tenet.
Well, be authentic with your your words stuff. But don't take things personally. Don't take things personally.
But that's all of the ego. If you turn on the news or even jump on Facebook for 5 minutes, all you have to mention is a name of a president, current or former. You just had, and it's like, it's gaslighting. People burn ourselves down. A lot of the talks I do is to help people stop living life through their political personality.
Yeah.
Because it's so small, it's a keyhole.
Oh.
And I always say too, and I did this when I was in Ontario, I say, listen, raise your hand if you've ever been to a wake, and everybody raised their hand. And I go through these different levels, somebody older than you, younger than you, somebody you knew, friend, whatever, and everybody's had this common experience of going to say goodbye to someone at a funeral home or a wake or a memorial. And then I say, ask them if they've ever been to a cemetery, and they all raise their hands, and I go through the same kind of levels. Then I say, have you ever seen Democrat or Republican on a headstone? Nobody's raised their hand in 15 years.
Yeah.
And I say to them, if it's not important when you leave, why do we make it the deciding factor when you're here? What you do see is father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, cousin, veteran, things that have deep, deep meaning, not politics. And it is the main divider for people. And I'm thinking to myself as we're sitting here, I bet you have all faiths come here.
All of them.
All backgrounds come here. Yeah. All colors come here. All creeds come here. All political persuasions come here looking for something they can't find out there.
Right. That's exactly right. Matter of fact, right next to us is the Hindu temple, the Chamaya Mission. The high priest in his little orange outfit, he comes over all the time. We sit by the koi pond and talk.
I bet those are some
Great conversations. Yeah, right. But he loves what I'm doing here, and I honor what he's doing there, and we're great neighbors, you know.
The first time I heard about Solder World, I was ordering a pizza from Philly's over on 83rd. And I walked in to get the pizza, and there was these, you know, brochures there, and I'm like, Solder World, pizza, sausage, beef, Solder World. What's the connection here?
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And then I'm thinking, it can't be Eric Soderholm who played for the Sox. And like, it's the same guy. Now, isn't that interesting? So that was kind of the first tug on the string. And like, I could have ignored it. I kept that brochure. I still have it somewhere. And I would go look at it and go, I think, and same thing, I think I need to go there. But I've lived most of my life sticking my nose in the wind going, go here, go without knowing.
Yeah.
So I'm glad somebody put him at Phillies because that was a good nudge. And what I want to wrap up with here is, you know, you have a lot of little ahas. We've had some great conversation here. There's been some serious teachings that really don't have anything to do with baseball because that's really, you know, kind of who you were and now this is who you are and you've been able to bridge the two. But is there and it may not even be a fair question, but it's the only, I've been thinking about it all day. Is there an overriding major aha for Eric Soderholm in his seventh decade?
Overriding. Just seems like, it seems like the universe is putting in front of me the things that I'm ready for at the time.
Mm.
And so the books came, and then the talking came, and then the realization, hey, I got to be what I'm talking about. And then
it's like climbing the ladder of consciousness, and you don't get what you need until you're ready for the next level.
Right. And the universe brings you.
And I don't think you can buy your. I don't think you can buy jump ahead. I don't think you get to cut in line.
No, it's kind of a slow journey. I know people have like near death experiences, and then they all of a sudden are completely transformed. For me, it was just a gradual feeling. You know, you can't put your hand on it, but it's like, you know, there's like 7 billion people on the planet. And the thing that always amazed me was that 6.5 billion of them believe in something they can't even see. Think about that. They might not be able to see it, but we can feel it.
Mm.
So I began to, in my studies and stuff, and starting to become what I was reading about and this and that, and letting go of my attachments to fear, realizing that I've got to let my ego surrender. You can only ever get rid of your ego.
Sure,
that's who
it's
you are in this life.
That's
part
exactly.
of who you are. You got to be thankful for
yes,
it.
Yes.
But the ego can surrender and let the higher self, which is really who you are, that energy of unconditional love, that energy of truth, that energy of peace and joy, that's who you really are. Because we're all sparks of God. And I hated it in the church when I kept saying, you're this poor, miserable sinner.
Mm-hmm.
When I know now that the exact opposite is the truth. You're this beautiful spark of God. And you're here to radiate your energy in the world and make a contribution to this world the best that you can.
Couldn't finish the broadcast any better than that, brother.
Oh, man. John, it was a great pleasure. I look forward to having you back out here as a speaker. You really, literally were probably, if not the best speaker, certainly a close second, if not best.
I appreciate
you
that.
You really did a great job of speaking that day that you were out here. And
you know, going back to before, the changes in my life have allowed me to get most of myself out of the way and let that stuff come through. Is where I spend most of my time to bring up the most within us.
Right.
So always great to see you.
And the interesting thing is that once you get it, you really appreciate the silence.
Absolutely.
You don't have to shout from the rooftop that, hey, I get it. You just stand in your light and it'll be for other people's victory.
You get a chance, you're in the Chicagoland area, you have to come out to Solder World, and if you just sit here, you'll probably run into Eric or his great staff, and they got everything from massage to the salt cave to, you know, you had the
yoga,
the shamans out here painting the wall and walking the path here, and you got the labyrinth and the koi pond, and, you know, it's just really interesting, as we talked a little bit before we even started, you know, to see the arc of someone's life change is a rare thing. Most people start the way finish the way they started. They just stay that way. No matter how many times the opportunities come in disguise for the universe to say, it's time to put up or shut up, time to grow up or get up. And most people dismiss that because it changes, as you said, it's fear. But here, it's like you've given permission for anybody and everybody to be a participant in change, not a victim of it.
You better have an open mind when you come to Solder World.
Absolutely. Appreciate the time.
John, always a pleasure.
Thanks,
anytime,
brother.
My friend.
You got it.
Thank
All
you.
Right. If you take the wisdom that this guy has shared and his insights on living and his observations on the game of baseball and all the rest of that stuff, I think that that's at the core, that just really distilled down to the core of what we all go through or have the opportunity to go through as human beings in this life experience. What so many people, and I've done this myself, it's the only reason I can even recognize this. Truly, the only way that I could see this in the struggle other people have is because I've struggled with it myself on and off for so long. In this world that we live in, you have to earn a living. And you have to do something to earn that living. Nobody gives you anything unless you win the lottery, and even then most people blow it, so what's the point? But you have to earn a living. I heard Earl Nightingale, the great speaker, who was just an amazing human being in his own right, way back in the 50s and 60s. I heard a record of his, and he said on there, it's really important to remember that the only people that make money work in the mint. The rest of us have to earn it. And earning it means you have to put your back into it and your head into it and your sweat and your equity and all those type of things. And that's not everybody. I get that some people got it coming right out of the chute. They never have a bad day. They make a bunch of cash. I heard yesterday that Kylie Jenner, she's almost worth $1 billion. I don't think she's ever had to do any babysitting to earn money or work at Dunkin' Donuts at 3 o'clock in the morning or substitute teach or whatever a lot of people go through. For whatever reason, Kylie Jenner was plucked from the universe and came through the chute and came out the other end. And at the age of 20, 21, somewhere in there, she hasn't really had to do anything. She just is herself, and that's worth about $1 billion. Walk out, don't smile, be real skinny, and wear stuff that people want to buy. I'm jealous. My point is, there's a great danger in confusing who you are with what you do. So if you're my dad, here's a perfect example. My dad was a banker. He worked in a bank his whole life. He worked in the banking industry for 35 years. So he always wanted to be an architect. And early circumstances changed his route. Got married, started having kids, took a job. Never left that vocation. So on one hand, there was a deep disappointment in my pop that he never became that architect. He would draw up plans. He worked on our house all the time. Most of the stuff getting finished, but that's another deal. He gave it his all, and he was this kind of the hidden architect. He wanted to build things and design things. And outside of Halloween every year when he designed the basement into a haunted house, he never had that chance. He went a different direction. So he was in banking for 35 years. He was well-respected, you know, did a great job. He's a hard-working guy. His discipline, I think, has stayed with me. I watch this man go to work every day, 9 to 5, like a clock. And, you know, but I also remember him coming home looking disappointed, like, you know, something's missing. He loved us, you know, loved his family, worked hard, put money in the bank, put a roof over our heads. I never went without. And yet there was something missing. And later in his life, after he had long retired and had some severe health challenges, it was in the last year of his life, actually, we had a long talk. We had a lot of long talks, had a lot of shit to clean up between father and son. And, you know, that's another piece of this. You know, as I've gotten older, my parents have gotten clearer, even though they've been gone a very long time. And one of the things I had to forgive them for, and then forgive myself for, was me thinking that they should have been different than they are, and that they were, which would somehow make my life different. You know, I had them on this pedestal to some degree of my parents, and they were flawed human beings like every other human being is. They had these great challenges, and yet despite the great challenges, they were great parents. So one kind of played off the other, but I had to forgive that, thinking they needed to be who I wanted them to be as opposed to who they are, and remove the conditions of that. Very, very important. That's a little sidebar here, but that would just popped into my head. It was crucial to me. And thank God I was able to clear all that up before my dad died. I didn't have that chance with my mom. We were pretty good anyway. She's a pretty straight shooter, kind of like me, I guess. My dad was kind of sat back a little bit more, but my mom would walk in the room and tell you what was wrong. And I think that's worked for me at times as well. So that's a little sidebar. But the one thing with my dad was you know, he had done this so much, he became that. And when he stopped doing it, he didn't think his life had any purpose. So there's a great challenge in that. And we are more aware of that than ever before. And because of the age we live in, you know, my dad would leave at 5 o'clock and nobody called him at home. He didn't have a beeper. He didn't have a cell phone. Nobody bothered him. And then he walked the next morning, 9 o'clock, pick it up and then leave it there. Those days are never coming back. So there is no escape route. And the tentacles of information are so prevalent that it makes things very difficult. So this concept of not confusing who you are with what you do in my own life has been another deal. It's like I answered the call to do radio. Never said I'd be famous, never said I'd make millions, never said I'd be a Howard Stern size audience or Rush Limbaugh or Oprah or anybody else. I added everything to that. And when it didn't become that, I mean, at one point there was 3 million people listening. That's not bad. But I thought I got to keep going. And somehow what I did defined me. It doesn't. There's an old saying, I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said, circumstances shouldn't define you, they reveal you. And that's the truth. So the circumstances of our lives are there not to define us. We're supposed to go past those because they show us who we are and who we're not. That's really the magic of this thing. And Eric Soderholm personifies to me a guy who was one way. He was aware enough and smart enough and able to listen to the nudges enough and trust enough in things he couldn't see to transform his life within his own life experience. So rare. You know, I know people that are arguing about shit their grandparents were arguing about with the neighbors. I mean, come on. So www.soderworldwellness.com. Try and say that 5 times. Soderworldwellness.com. And you can click on and see all the great things that got to go on at the center and the events and the workshops, the continuing education. And when you're stressed beyond the max, this is the best place in the Chicagoland area to go check it out. Massage therapies, skin and body treatments, holistic health care, great speakers. I mean, they got everything going on. Take a walk on the path that Eric and I were sitting at. It's just a phenomenal experience. So SoderWorldWellness.com, that's how you find them. Now, here's what I started at the beginning of the show. I'm giving a talk at Solder World in January, kind of kicking off the year. And I'm getting on a roll, really 8, 9, 10 minutes in. I got everything going on and we got a nice room full of people. And I'm feeling like this is another one of those things. This is why I'm on the planet. I'm going to deliver the mail. And there's the door opens to the room and everything stops. And this guy walks in. His name's Scott. Scott walks in the room. I have not seen Scott in 40 years. Scott was one of my teammates at Schurz High School on the football team. Outstanding athlete, great guy, a lot of fun. I just melted. He walked in the room like he had just seen me at practice the day before, with the same smile on his face, a lot less hair. I have less hair too, so we're the same. And he walks in, and I just felt like, not only was it confirmation I was right where I was supposed to be that day, and that's how I interpreted it, but something else clicked in. To this day, I can't explain it, except the reverse was the message. Instead of me being the teacher, I was now the student, and there's nothing more powerful than knowing that you're both. And Scott walked in, and I was about near tears, and we hugged, and I had to tell the story. And I don't know what brought him there that day, but it was just a gift. And that happened on that property. And so if you get a chance to go there, you might run into people they haven't seen for a very long time. Adios.